Welcome to Sidetrack, AM580's monthly features magazine. I'm your host, Jason Croft. This month, we talk to The Daily Show's Stephen Colbert about the program's new publication, America the Book, A Citizen's Guide to Democracy in Action. We learn about the Dodgeball Society at the University of Illinois. A local musician talks about growing up with Champaign's 70s progressive rock group, Starcastle. And we get our yearly ghost hunting update. Those stories and more, this time on Sidetrack. Most people remember the game of dodgeball from elementary school, that gym and recess game that actually promoted hitting others with hard rubber balls. Now the adult version of the game is growing in popularity, spurred on in part by the hit summer movie Dodgeball. A couple of student dodgeball groups have started here at the University of Illinois. I recently stopped by the first gathering of one of them, the Dodgeball Society, to see how the game is played today.
My name is Mike Osterhout. I'm playing some dodgeball here tonight.
Okay, so what prompted you to start up a dodgeball group?
Well, about 4 or 5 years ago, my brother started one up back home at Western Springs. So, I transferred from Illinois State University. We had one there also. So I figured those two are successful, why not be successful here at U of I?
So explain to those who might not know, might not remember from elementary school, the rules of dodgeball.
Well, there are a lot of different rules people play, but what we play, when you get hit by a ball from being thrown from an opponent, you're out. If you catch it, someone from your team gets to come back in. If they're out, if no one's out, then whoever threw the ball you caught is out. Basic rules.
So why don't you show me what the actual dodgeball is? Because this might be different from what people remember.
The dodgeball we use it's a foam ball with vinyl coating around it. It's a relatively hard foam, but it's still pretty soft, I'd say. It's nothing like the old school rubber balls. We used to play with that way back when, about 4 years ago. Once we figured out they're actually official dodgeballs now, we started using those.
Those look like big sort of Nerf balls rather than, like you said, the old rubber balls.
It's Nerf ball with a vinyl coat around it.
Does that take away some of the sting? Because, you know, back when I remember playing dodgeball, you didn't want to get hit because, not just for the game, but for the pain.
Oh, no, it doesn't take away. It takes away some of the sting. Yeah, it's a lot safer, I'd say, but these guys can throw pretty fast, and any velocity, it'll sting.
So what is it about dodgeball that keeps you wanting to play and has you forming groups like this?
Well, it actually ends up to be a very good team sport. I made a lot of friends through dodgeball back home and at Illinois State University. So, I keep coming out because it's really fun. It takes an extreme amount of athleticism, even though it doesn't seem like it. I move around a lot, and I wear knee pads, so I take some bumps. I actually dislocated my finger once, so the balls aren't that soft.
So it doesn't have anything to do with pounding an opponent with a Nerf ball?
Not me personally. I'm sure some of the guys come out here for getting the hits, taking out some frustration, but I just love playing the sport, and this is one of the unique sports I'd love to play.
I'm Paula Banzer. I'm the treasurer of the Dodgeball Society. And I think what's great about it is it brings tons of people together. Even if you haven't played sports in high school or didn't play all the same sports, dodgeball, no one has a background in really from high school being on a team. So it's a chance for everyone to start from scratch and play together. And it's just good teamwork skills you learn and things like that.
Being a woman playing dodgeball, the guys on the team treat you any differently? Do they throw just as hard or what? Is there an advantage or a disadvantage?
It depends on the person. Some people aim for the girls right away to get people out on the other team, but other guys want to be nice, and they don't throw at you right away, and they wait till the end to throw at you. So it depends on the guy, and a lot of times it's to your advantage if they take it easy on you at first, but then they get to know you, and they know that you're here to play, and they don't take it easy on you anymore.
My name's Mike Fleming, and I just play it because it's fun, pretty much.
I saw during that last game you were employing the getting two balls, you know, like getting all the ammo sort of technique.
Yeah.
Is that more effective than just sort of one ball at a time?
It depends. Like, sometimes it's good for blocking. It's good if you throw one, and then you have an extra one to throw right away to throw off their game.
So what is your main strategy when you play dodgeball?
I basically try to aim low towards the feet and just go for the most intimidating players first and try to pick them off one by one.
Tell me, if people are interested in dodgeball, what should they do?
If they're U of I students, they can check it out on the RSO website, or I made it easier. You can email me at dodgeballsociety@hotmail.com if you do have any questions. Any non-U of I students can get involved in an organization called NADA, which is NADA. It's the National Amateur Dodgeball Association. They hold tournaments in Schaumburg, Illinois. The Western Springs, which I belong to, are three-year champions of it. So come on out and we could try to beat you.
Members of the U of I's Dodgeball Society. You've got it tuned to Sidetrack. One way to learn about technology is to take things apart and put them back together. Our engineer Bill Hammack tried it recently with his computer, and in the process, he marveled at the magic of the microchip.
Last night, as I put together a PC, I examined the computer's memory chip, in technical parlance, a 32-megabyte DRAM chip. It seems innocuous. It has no moving parts, and yet because it's part of the electronic revolution, will change the world. So revolutionary is the chip that we've listened to a decade of jabbering about the new economy. The implication is that the microchip leaves behind the industrial world of manufacturing, the days of grimy work putting together things like washing machines or cars. No doubt the microchip is revolutionary, but make no mistake, it's very much part of the old industry, as much as the new. In fact, by some measures, even more so. It's just hidden from us. A key measure of the environmental impact of manufacturing something is the weight of fossil fuel required to produce it relative to the product's weight. For example, in building a car, you need steel, plastic, paint, and so on. So if you add up all the fuel used to make these parts, and then add in the energy needed to make the car itself, you'll find that for every pound of car produced, it takes 2 pounds of fuel. Now, compare this to a microchip, in fact, that 32-megabyte chip I mentioned. This tiny, non-moving thing takes an astounding 630 times its own weight in fossil fuel to make. How could this be possible? Purity is the answer. A chip is made of silicon, the main ingredient of sand. To work its magic, the silicon used must be extraordinarily pure. If you were to shrink to the size of an atom and wander through the silicon used to make this chip, you'd pass by a million silicon atoms before you'd find a single impurity. Any more than that, and the chip won't work. Now, to purify sand to this point takes a huge amount of energy, about a quarter of the total energy needed to produce the chip. In addition, all this work must be done in a clean room, that is, a room which is many times tidier than a hospital operating room. The climate and ventilation of the room must be rigorously controlled. This takes about 50% of the energy used to make the chip. So the upshot is this. During its lifetime, a microchip uses very little energy, but it takes a great deal to produce it. For example, if you buy 8 new computers over a period of 10 years, the total energy used would equal that needed to produce a car. So this notion that the microchip makes for a brand new economy is only half right. It's very useful to keep our eye on that other half that is still the old industrial manufacturing. It reminds us that there is no free lunch.
The comments of Bill Hammack, who teaches chemical engineering at UIUC. His essays on engineering and life can be found on the web at engineerguy.com. This is Sidetrack. I'm Jason Croft. Last month, The Daily Show with Jon Stewart picked up 2 Emmys, one for Outstanding Variety Music or Comedy Series, and one for Outstanding Writing for a Variety Music or Comedy Program. The show has gained a strong following, especially with young adults, for its satirical look at politics, current events, and the news media itself. The folks at The Daily Show have recently ventured into the realm of the printed page with their new book, America, the Book, A Citizen's Guide to Democracy in Action. It's published by Warner Books. One of the contributors for the book and The Daily Show itself is Stephen Colbert. I talked with Colbert just after their Emmy wins and asked him about the popularity of the show and how the program has covered the 2004 presidential campaign.
So how does it feel to realize that most young people today are getting their news and political analysis from The Daily Show?
I feel very powerful. Feel like a giant. I bestride the world like a colossus. I've seen those polls. It was one poll. It was the Pew Research Center did a poll that said that a majority of people 18 to 34 got their news from sources like The Daily Show, not necessarily The Daily Show.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't necessarily believe it because people would not tune into The Daily Show to get educated because we don't educate them that much. They tune in, I think, to see our take on a news story these people already know about, or else they just wouldn't get our jokes.
Well, it's sort of like the old Fat Albert cartoon, you know, the disclaimer that Bill Cosby would give. You know, if you're not careful, you just might learn something.
Yeah.
You know, so that's kind of, I think, what The Daily Show is.
Yeah, we bawomba educate the people, but that's my Fat Albert.
Well, you guys do have a certain amount of credibility out there, whether
yeah,
you want
ridiculous.
It or not.
That's ridiculous that we have credibility. I was on Howie Kurtz's Reliable Sources during the New Hampshire campaign, and I opened my interview by reminding him that there is not a less reliable source to be had than me.
I know, but John Edwards came on the program, announced
yes.
his presidential campaign.
Right.
John Kerry.
And he did very well, by the way.
Yeah.
I think he won South Carolina, and that's it.
Well, but now he's the running mate to John Kerry. Which I think is not a bad trade-off.
No. Consolation prize.
But John Kerry, you know, he came on the show. He was shunning all the other Sunday morning talk shows and primetime news magazines.
Right.
And then he appears on The Daily Show. And you guys get front-page news everywhere.
We think he was actually lost and was just trying. He was just asking to use our phone so he could make his way over to 60 Minutes. But
he
just needed a warm place.
Well, how does that affect you guys when you realize, you know, what you guys do suddenly makes the top story on all the other news media?
It doesn't affect what we do at all because we don't consider ourselves news. So, like, success in terms of, like, making news or reporting news is not our goal. It's sort of incidental to what we do.
Mm-hmm.
And it's we're very grateful that people like John Kerry would want to come on our show. But still, our objective at all times is to be funny. And so it gets attention for the show, so people will watch our jokes, but we don't confuse ourselves with the news.
Right. Well, some other people just might, which is...
Yeah, they do. They do, and I think they confuse us with the news because they confuse the 24-hour news channels with
mm-hmm.
news. Because, you know, with 24 hours to fill, these news channels have to rely a lot on analysis. And analysis is a form of entertainment. It's not really informational. And it's conjecture. You know, it's crystal ball gazing. And our show is like that more than it is like, you know, hard news. And so I think that's where the confusion comes, is how far toward entertainment news has had to come. It's not that we're that close to news.
Well, that's actually one of the points you bring up in the America the Book.
Oh, yes, we have a new book.
Yeah. And, you know, that book covers... you know, basically sort of the idiot's guide to American democracy. And it also has a chapter about the media and the modern media. And you actually have a feature in there, a nice photographic feature called Stephen Colbert's Guide to Dressing and Expressing Like a TV Journalist.
Yes. It's 90% of the work is finding the right tie.
Well, tell us.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, just tell us about that. You know, how is that what it is? It's just looking good. Is that all it takes?
Well, you've also, you know, got to have what we call gravitas, which generally means a deep voice. And after that, it helps to be able to pronounce things well. You know, actually having access to people is just gravy at that point. But you do definitely want to look the part. If you're out in the field, you got to have the safari jacket on, because half of reporting is having enough pockets. And a bandana is important to wear around your neck if you're in a hot country, because it lets people know that you're sweating, because sweat doesn't generally play on video very well, so you have to, you know, telegraph the idea that you're hot and this is an arduous condition for you.
Mm-hmm.
And don't be afraid to show some leg, I find.
Well, I also love it recently with all the hurricanes hitting.
Yes.
The guys, you know, out there in their rain ponchos,
right,
in the middle of the storm going,
yeah,
it's wet and raining. And, you know, then the anchor back at the desk says, you know, stay dry.
Yeah, yeah. You be careful out there. You know what you might want to do? Not stand in a hurricane.
Getting back to your sort of fake political coverage, you actually made it to both the major party political conventions this year.
Right down there on the floor, mixing with the demigods.
Well, what is that like to actually get down there and get into the nitty-gritty of that sort of political process and then do what you do?
It's very hot. That's another thing you can't tell. It's really hot on the floor of that convention. It's swampy. You know, those people are in a fevered froth over their candidate, and there is just not an inch to move around, and you know, you're wearing a wool suit, and it's like reporting from an orgy, actually, except everyone's got their clothes on, and you hope it stays that way, because delegates generally are not the most toned people in the world. The Democratic convention was actually more exciting, because I feel like, you know, insurgents always have a little bit more excitement, and they're taking a greater risk, and the Democrats, also being a diverse party, don't know each other. You know, they're hooking up, they're meeting each other for the first time. The Republican convention, though it played well on TV, was a dud in the room. Everybody already knows each other. 83% of them are white and middle class. And as soon as the balloons dropped, they left.
Well, also, in your actual coverage,
yeah,
they looked like they wanted to have nothing to do with you.
Well, they were not as receptive, I have to say. They were a little chilly. Perhaps they've seen the show.
Well, that's the what it... I guess what it boils down to, you know, these people have seen the show, so why do they even let you in?
Well, the freedom of the press, they actually have to let us in.
Well, you were also part of the Indecision 2000 coverage,
yeah,
that the Daily Show did. How does the 2004 presidential contest compare to that 4 years ago?
Gosh, it's hard to remember the actual campaign.
Right.
Because
of everything that happened after.
The campaign became so much greater than everything that led up to it,
mm-hmm,
because it's so overshadowed by the unbelievable more repeatable, perfect news story that followed, in that it involved everyone, it mattered to everyone, and no one got hurt. You know, and this mm-hmm. year the stakes are actually much higher because, you know, we're in a war, we're in a time of national crisis, and so in a way there's less to be funny about in terms of the issues of the campaign, but I think people are more tuned in. I mean, people are making their minds up a lot sooner than they did in 2000. So I think people are paying attention to the political process more than they ever have before.
Well, you brought up a point about, you know, how things have become much more serious in world matters.
Yep.
Does that limit you guys to what you can write about and what is funny?
We were never interested in writing about tragedy. We're more interested in writing about the people or the political machinations that lead us to tragedy, or how it's dealt with, or how it's politicized. Those are things that are worthy of satire, I think. So are there large chunks of the news that we have to shy away from? Sure. But there's always enough. There's always enough of the other.
Mm-hmm. The book that you are a collaborator with, this America the Book, it's really funny because it's laid out like an old high school textbook.
And I suggest that high schools use it. Well, buy it in order that I make money.
Well, it covers sort of the history of America, past, present, and even future.
Yes.
And describes the branches of government. But there's sort of this underlying message that American democracy is really not a bad thing, except for the people who run it, and they screw it all up.
Well, right. It's like Churchill said, democracy is the worst possible form of government except for all the others. Democracy is a wonderful idea if people get involved, but democracy can't live by itself. You know, democracy is not self-generating. It's just made up of people, and it has human flaws, and unless people are held accountable, it'll just be a series of the flaws and never be corrected unless people get involved and vote. So there. That's my serious statement for the day.
Well, it seems that what the underlying message of what you guys do at The Daily Show and of this book is, like, you know, just don't sit there and passively accept, you know, what people are feeding you. You know, if you don't like it, you know, make a difference.
Absolutely.
And
there's only one thing to do.
Yeah.
And that's vote.
Uh-huh.
It is absolutely dumbfounding to me when people say, oh, you know, my vote doesn't matter. Or, you know, I hate it when people say, well, it doesn't matter what I do. I'm in a red state or I'm in a blue state. It's like, well, no, surrendering. That is abdicating your rights to the news media, because the news media has told you that you're a red state. Did you know you were a red state? No. You've been polled, and they found out that a majority of the people in your state, you know, want Bush, and therefore you go, oh, so why vote?
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, 15,000 of you decide to vote for Kerry, you're not a red state anymore, and vice versa. I mean, this is a two-way street. I find that incredibly distressing that people accept the red state, blue state model of the United States.
Well, also, it is also distressing that the candidates believe in that polling, too, and you only see them going to, like, five or six states for the whole presidential election.
Yeah, well, yeah, I mean, that's the influence of money, because, you know, so much money is poured into it, and it has to be, you know, poured only down, you know, in only into certain troughs. So, I mean, that's a very mercenary decision on their part. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's that they don't care about what happens, and I think Kerry cares what happens to citizens in Texas, and I believe that Bush cares what happens to citizens in Massachusetts, but they're just being realistic.
Well, in the back of your book, you actually sort of play off on the whole presidential election as sporting event near the back of it. You
exactly,
know.
The thriller in vanilla, Bush versus Kerry.
Because in the back you actually have, you know, the debate scorecard with a special scoring system. So you can know, you know, what they do and what they don't do and what they get points for doing,
mm-hmm.
or evading.
Right.
The tail of the tape.
Right.
You know, that's some great stuff. So what's next for you guys now, drunk off of your Emmy win?
Well, we'll put our clothes back on, and we'll leave the hotel room.
Mm-hmm. And the America the Book, Is that out now?
It's available.
Mm-hmm.
Go to your local small bookseller, have a cup of coffee, and then learn all about our nation.
That was Stephen Colbert of The Daily Show with Jon Stewart. He is one of the contributors to America the Book, A Citizen's Guide to Democracy in Action. It's published by Warner Books. Still to come on the program, our annual ghost hunting update, and a local musician remembers Champaign's 70s progressive rock group, Starcastle. Stay tuned. You're listening to Sidetrack. I'm Jason Croft. Pulp novels, those crime fiction paperbacks that were popular in the 1940s and 50s for their tough guy stories and lurid painted covers, are making a comeback. A new series called Hard Case Crime is reviving the crime paperback genre with a combination of reprints and modern works. One of the men behind the project is Charles Ardai. I asked him to tell us a little bit about the series.
Hard Case Crime is a new series of paperback crime novels that revives the style, the look and feel of the great pulp era. Back in the 1940s and 1950s, the pulp crime novel was enormously popular. Hundreds of millions of copies were sold of writers like Mickey Spillane and Earl Stanley Gardner and Ian Fleming. But today, there's no comparable line of books, so somebody who wants that kind of old-fashioned pulp crime story has to go get it at the movies or on TV, and we're bringing it back to the bookstores.
Now, what is it about the pulp novel that drove you to want to put together this series?
Well, you know, the writers I love, people like Lawrence Block and Elmore Leonard and Ed McBain, Donald Westlake, are still writing and writing wonderful novels, but only one a year. So that means that on 361 days a year, I have nowhere to go for a great story because there's no old-fashioned imprint that I can walk in and buy on an average week. That's why we recreated it. We created Hard Case Crime so that somebody who loves old-fashioned crime stories can go into the bookstore any month and pick up a new title they haven't read. Now, half our line is going to be reprints of old books from the pulp era, but we're picking rare ones, so even those are going to be books that today's readers haven't read and can find the kind of story that they might enjoy seeing at the movies or watching on TV only between the covers of a book.
Yeah, I was just going to ask you about that. Like you said, part of this, the series is older books that probably haven't seen the light of day for 30 years, and a part of this is newer writers. Is that something you thought consciously of doing when you started up this project?
Absolutely. You know, there are some treasures out there that have been lost for years. For instance, the fellow who wrote the Hitchcock movie To Catch a Thief also wrote a wonderful book called Plunder of the Sun, which is a kind of proto-Indiana Jones adventure novel set in South America, men on the run and lost gold and so forth. And it hasn't been published in more than 40 years. And it's a great book. When you read it, it's exciting and thrilling and wonderful. So we're bringing that back. The fellow who wrote Touch of Evil, which became the Orson Welles movie, Wade Miller, wrote another book called Branded Woman, which, again, is just fantastic. But it hasn't been published in almost 50 years. So it's very exciting to rediscover these lost gems and bring them back. But it's equally important, we think, to cultivate the next generation of great writers, the next generation of Elmore Leonards and Lawrence Blocks and Donald Westlakes. The problem is, without an imprint like Hard Case Crime, where are those writers going to get published? And that's why half our line is going to be brand new books by young writers who are just starting out but are writing phenomenal books.
Well, for those who don't know, sort of explain the whole pulp crime novel genre, because it's sort of a specific formula in a way.
Uh-huh. Well, the thing that makes this hard-boiled crime fiction really work is a kind of modern, cynical attitude. It's not Sherlock Holmes with the deerstalker cap, and it's not Agatha Christie with polite murders in the vicarage. It's much more in the style of Raymond Chandler with his Philip Marlowe stories. These are usually tough men who are in dangerous situations, or tough women in some cases, and have to prove themselves. Either they're innocent men who are thought guilty of some crime and they have to prove themselves innocent, or they're tough detectives who are facing incredible odds. If you think of a movie like The Fugitive with Harrison Ford, that gives you the sort of ultimate noir story. You come home one day, your wife's been murdered, people think you did it, and you have to prove otherwise. That's an exciting, suspenseful, noir pulp story. And there are other examples as well. A recent movie like Ocean's 11 with its heist story, or The Bourne Supremacy with the hitman who doesn't remember that he's a hitman. These kinds of stories are irresistible. They're gripping, they grab you on page one, and you can't put them down until you've turned the last page.
Well, the other great thing about pulp novels are the covers. And, you know, you just can't have a good pulp novel without a nice, lurid cover to match. And you guys have really done your homework when it comes to this, and you've actually found some of the greats when it comes to pulp covers, including Robert McGinnis.
Uh-huh. Well, Bob McGinnis is a terrific painter. He's a virtuoso who painted many famous movie posters, like the poster for Breakfast at Tiffany's with Audrey Hepburn and the cigarette holder. He also created the original posters for the Sean Connery James Bond movies, and more than 1,000 paperback novel covers. So having the chance to work with him and having him paint covers for our series is really an honor, and it's a kind of benediction from on high for our series, because it's a little touch of the original pulp era. But we're also working with painters who are very talented and work today for the movie studios, doing movie posters, work for comic book publishers, doing covers of comics, people like Rick Farrell and Greg Manchus, who are also enormously talented. And the key was to do the kind of paintings that used to grace covers in the 1940s and 50s, but that you don't see in bookstores much anymore. Beautiful women, tough men, menacing situations. These kinds of paintings were used to catch people's attention as they passed through Grand Central Station on the way to work, and they were supposed to stop you in your tracks, be so lurid, so provocative that they would stop you in your tracks, and you just couldn't pass them by without buying them. That's the kind of cover art we're doing.
Well, I'm a big fan of pulp paperbacks myself. I have quite a few. And, you know, sometimes the cover is much better than what's actually in the book.
It's true. You know, most of these books, when they were first published, probably shouldn't have been. They were badly written very quickly just for the money. The typical pulp novel was pretty bad. We have a big advantage, which is that we have been able to read hundreds of these things and pick out the very best. And so anyone who buys the Hard Case Crime book knows that they're having the benefit of our editorial work. We're not going to reprint anything that isn't really, really good. And as far as the new books go, we're going to writers like Dominic Stansberry, who may not be as well known as some of the old-timers, but has been nominated twice for the Edgar Allan Poe Award, which is the highest honor in mystery writing. And we also have folks who are very well reviewed by places like The New Yorker and The New York Times writing books for us. These are people who really love the old-fashioned storytelling that you could find in pulp novels and don't see so much on bookshelves anymore.
If people want to find more about Hard Case Crime books, where should they go to?
The website is www.hardcasecrime.com, all one word. And if they want to find copies of the books, I'm pleased to say they can find them in any local bookstore, in the big chains or smaller ones, or through booksellers like Amazon.com, BarnesandNoble.com.
That was Charles Ardai, one of the people behind the new pulp paperback series, Hard Case Crime.
You've got attuned to Sidetrack. Last month, Champaign Urbana lost an important member in the area's music scene. Gary Strader was the bassist for Starcastle, a progressive rock band from the 1970s and one of the biggest bands to come out of the Twin Cities. Over two decades later, the band's influence is still being felt, especially for those who grew up listening to their music. One such person influenced by Starcastle is WILL's Henry Frayne. Frayne is also the creative force behind the band Lanterna. And for him, Starcastle helped define what rock music should be.
Being a working musician and a guy who's played in a number of local bands over the years, I invariably get asked about my musical influences. Along with U2 and The Who, the Champaign progressive rock band Starcastle ranks pretty high on my list. Now, I didn't come to rock and roll in the usual way, mainly because my father was a classical music radio announcer on the side. It wasn't that pop music wasn't allowed, it's just that we didn't know much about it. In 1974, when I was 9, my older brother and I acquired an AM radio. This was still the era of the big AM rock stations. We quickly discovered WLS from Chicago and the joys of Top 40 radio. Fast forward to the summer of 76. I discovered that you could actually go out and buy singles. My first one was Edgar Winter's Frankenstein. It was my older brother, the one who I shared that AM radio with, who discovered the untouched world, at least untouched in my 12-year-old universe, of rock LPs. My brother was 5 years older than me and a few months away from leaving for college at the University of Wisconsin. At the time, he was working at the Champaign Central High School student paper. In January 1977, they interviewed Starcastle, Champaign's answer to progressive rock bands like Yes and Rush. He brought home a copy of their second album, Fountains of Light. Now, as I said, rock albums were a new concept to me. We tore off the shrink wrap and threw on side two. We didn't quite understand the concept of playing side one first. I heard the most heavenly sound come out of our small, green-glowing Panasonic stereo player. True to the light, we stand in endless motion. True to the million stars, we long to know the sea. Stretching our hands to feel the wind's emotion. Faces of dark. The song was true to the light. The sound was warm, fuzzy, clean, and pure. Now, it may be the child critic in me, but I never found another band that came close to creating such otherworldly music. How did a band from Champaign, Illinois, stumble onto the music of the ages? Because of the article in the student paper, I knew that they were from here. I had a friend who delivered papers to the grandmother's house with a guitarist, where the band seemed to spend a lot of time when they weren't on tour. But at the age of 12, I hadn't really made the fan connection of, I like this band, I have to see them live. I don't think I even knew that bands played live. And listening to their music, it made more sense that they were from Venus as Champaign. A friend in junior high once accused me of only buying albums with castles and swords on them. When my brother came back from college for Thanksgiving 1977, he brought back records by English art rockers Yes, King Crimson, and the holy grail of 70s rock, Led Zeppelin IV. Along with converting me into a total British progressive rock fan, it also made me really want a new Starcastle album. I didn't have long to wait. Their third album, Citadel, was out by Christmas. Citadel's cover art was painted by the Hildebrandt brothers, known for their poster for Star Wars 6 months before, and the 1977 Tolkien calendar, which was on my wall and the walls of most of my friends. Someone at Star Castle's record company knew their target audience. Although I've changed the calendar on my wall many times over, those Star Castle albums are as fresh today as they were in the 70s. And with the passing of Star Castle's bassist Gary Strader, their music has been on my mind more these days. Their sound was music from outer space, which in a strange twist of fate, came from my own hometown.
Venus brings her morning, and morning brings her life. The planet's never-ending cycle, darkness now to light. Keepers of the planet have chosen to ignore her life support systems as well as the ocean floor. Change in time, when the poets rhyme, a line so fine, is the planet's balance in question?
Henry Frayne is a technical director at WILL, and when he's not doing that, he's touring with his band Lanterna.
You're listening to Sidetrack. Every year around this time, we like to find out what's happening in the world of ghost hunting. Troy Taylor is the author of Haunted Illinois and one of the founders of the American Ghost Society, which is based in Alton. We last talked with him in 2002. I got a hold of him recently and asked him, what's new in the world of ghost hunting?
Well, you know, as far as things that are new in the world of ghost hunting, I'd have to say that not a lot is new. a lot of it is old, which is good, because I think that as far as, you know, ghost hunting goes, that search for evidence, I think that people are realizing that some of the, you know, tried and true methods and techniques and ideas are really becoming worthwhile again. On the other hand, I do find that a lot of those tried and true techniques have been updated so that we're using today's technology, I suppose you would say, in ways that they were, you know, ghost hunters of old were using the same types of things. When a ghost hunter in the old days would use some string and a jar of flour to see if anybody passed through, today's ghost hunter uses, infrared motion detectors and that sort of thing. Photography has come a long way in the last couple of years. People are still using the tried and true 35mm, which is really still the best method to use when trying to capture evidence of ghosts. But people are also discovering that some of the old digital cameras, some of the early ones that were becoming so popular with ghost hunters because you could take all the pictures you wanted, wouldn't have to use any film, and there's no cost, and et cetera, are realizing finally, as I've been trying to tell people for years, really aren't that good because they really just don't capture true images. They're too easily manipulated. They don't work well in low light. And people are finally realizing that now you can actually get good digital cameras, 8-megapixel and better cameras, that really do capture true images, that actually do produce what really would be a digital negative embedded in their code so that they can see if the photographs have been manipulated and that sort of thing. So as far as ghost hunting goes, there are some new things, new versions of old things for the most part. But For me, in ghost hunting, a lot of my ghost hunting doesn't necessarily mean going out trying to, you know, always track down evidence. I love to do it, but a lot of my ghost hunting becomes trying to track down new stories. And believe it or not, you would think that I would have Illinois kind of tapped out by now with as many things as I've done about Illinois, but actually I'm finding new places all the time.
Like
and,
what?
Well, some of the new places. I recently, or by the time this is probably aired, a new edition of Haunted Illinois will be out. This was actually the third edition of the book, which is how many new things I've been finding. And this is a more traveler-friendly version of the book, offering directions and ideas about how to get to some of the places. But I've run across a number of new spots, which, of course, really aren't new, but they're new for me, new for the readers. The Oakville Original Springs down in Oakville, Illinois, apparently had been haunted for years, but had never really come to anyone's attention, really. The owners were well aware that the place was haunted. It's an interesting place. Oakville is just this tiny little town off Interstate 64, which, of course, was there long before Interstate 64 was. But they have what is Illinois' only still operating mineral springs, where people can actually come, take in the waters, drink the waters. Has a lot of, it's believed, curative powers, a lot of, if nothing else, invigorating powers to the water. But the hotel that has been built there, it's been there since the middle 1800s, is very haunted. They have a lot of different kinds of activity, a lot of ghost sightings, footsteps, doors that open and close, lights that turn on and off, you know, your typical ghostly kinds of things, but it's a great location. That's one of the many places that I've run across pretty recently.
Well, what are the current trends? What are people reporting? What are ghost hunters looking out for?
Well, as far as speaking for myself personally, I'm always on the lookout for an active location that has a great history behind it, and that's one of the things that I find that ghost hunters are starting to really search for, to look for. They're beginning to realize that just because a place may be haunted and may have some activity, if you can't find out why that activity's there, it makes it almost impossible to do any kind of research there. So people are starting to realize the importance of the history at these locations, and that's one of the things that I find more and more people now starting to look for. It's been something that it's been important to me always, just because I've always been a history buff, and that's really something that I specialize in. But I'm finding that it's starting to finally catch on, and people are being intrigued by it. So that's something that I know a lot of other people are looking for. It's something I'm always on the lookout for. A great story is always something I'm on the lookout for, though. So I guess that can't really I can't say that that's a new trend, but it is something that I think is people are finding to be very important.
Well, you mentioned the springs earlier. Are there any other interesting places that you've been investigating?
Yeah, actually, last year I ran across a location that I've started to do some more work with, a place called the Coliseum Ballroom in Bunnell, Illinois. Again, one of those places that's been around forever, and it's one of those places that people have talked about being haunted, but it really hasn't come to the attention of too many researchers, and it's never appeared in any of the books, in any books before, actually. In fact, the new Illinois book will be the first book that it's ever appeared in print. The Coliseum was started back in the 1920s, right on what was then Route 66. Route 66, a few years later, would kind of veer over in 1930 and bypass Bunnell a little bit, but it was a really hot place when it opened. What was interesting about it is that Bunnell is a tiny little mining town, but it had a reputation for the number of bars and brothels and that sort of thing that were located in town. It was said on their very short little main street there were over 100 of these places. But the Coliseum opened up. It cost about $50,000 in 1928 in this little bitty town. A lot of people kind of questioned, you know, where the money came from, what was involved, what was going on. Well, it turns out that the owner of the place was later arrested for bootlegging and for being involved in illegal liquor sales in the area. And before he was about to testify, he disappeared. And they found him a few days later shot in the back of the head and floating in the Sangamon River. So the mob ties that were suspected about the place were probably true. But the place was run by his daughter for a number of years and became a really, really popular hotspot. From the big band era, they had all the big band performers, from the Glenn Miller Band to just about everybody else through the 1930s and 40s played at the Coliseum. Later on, it turned into more of a rock and roll venue, and again, all the greats, Chuck Berry, Chubby Checker, Bill Haley and the Comets, and then on, Bob Seger, Fleetwood Mac, all kinds of people played up into the late 70s at the Coliseum. And eventually then it sort of faded out of existence and closed down. And it's now open as an antique mall. But again, it's one of those places where events from the past and the history of the past has really left an impression on this place, because people now have had all sorts of experiences with seeing ghosts in, you know, in evening clothes and hearing music play and just a variety of different things. It's turned out to be a very haunted place.
So for those of us who in the Champaign-Urbana and surrounding areas who during the Halloween season want to go out and sort of encounter our own ghostly experience, if we're lucky, where would you suggest we go?
You know, that's a tough one. Believe it or not, it's tough. Champaign-Urbana has always been kind of a tough place for me to find a lot of material about. There's a few U of I stories, and of course there's, you know, Clement Cemetery. You may be familiar with the story about the Blue Man. They say if you go out there on certain nights to the cemetery, I believe when the moon is full, that you will see this glowing blue man who was hanged there or committed suicide there, depending on the version of the story you hear, a number of years ago. I don't know how this story got started. I haven't been able to find any background behind it, but it is a story that I do often hear about that area. If you don't mind traveling just a little bit, you wouldn't have to go too far, but there are some other places to go. Eastern Illinois University, of course, has its own resident ghost at Pemberton Hall. Mary Hawkins is a ghost who haunts Pemberton Hall. It's a counselor who died or committed suicide a number of years ago after one of her students that she took care of was murdered, and she is said to have haunted the building ever since. This story is interesting because it does have some real actual historical roots. Plus, it also has a background of a lot of women who've lived in the building who've had very strange experiences there. So that's one of those ongoing stories that I've always been pretty impressed with. If you head out to the Arcola area, which is not too terribly far, you will run into a little town called Chesterville. There isn't much to see in Chesterville. It's just a handful of houses. But right out on the edge of town, across this rickety one-lane bridge that was obviously built for Amish buggies and not for cars, there is a little cemetery that holds what's been known as a witch's grave. The cemetery is very small. It's off to the side of the road. The grave's not hard to find because it was a grave that was built into a fenced area, and then a tree was planted so that it grew up right over the middle of the grave. Now, the story is that the tree was planted there on purpose to try to keep the soul of the witch from returning as a ghost. It doesn't seem to have helped, though, because there have been a lot of people who claim to have encountered a woman in the cemetery wandering near these graves. So maybe it didn't keep her in the ground, but at least it kept her close by. There's another great location. I got to mention this one because it's, again, not too far away. And it's another sort of witch's grave. But near Ashmore, Illinois, there is a little cemetery called St. Omer's. And it's one of those places where you blink, you'll miss it because you can't see it from the road. It's off into the woods. But it's a nice, neat, well-kept little cemetery. And it also has what's called a witch's grave in it. It's a very interesting grave. It looks like it's stone that's been fashioned into what looks like logs. And on top of the logs is this round ball that is dedicated to the Barnes family. Now, it seems to be just sort of an interesting gravestone until you start to look at it closely and you check the name of a woman named Elizabeth Barnes. Now, Elizabeth, her name appears on just one side of the ball, and it appears to be very ordinary. Her birth date is listed there, and below that is what is supposed to be her death date. Now, the death date on the ball is February the 31st, 1882. Now, since February doesn't have 31 days, people have wondered why in the world this stone happened to be carved that way. Well, local legend has it that this woman was a witch and who had vowed to return on the anniversary of her death. Well, yeah, they felt if they marked the stone with a date that did not exist, she'd never come back. I don't know if that story's true. I've talked to a lot of people who claim that the tombstone glows at night, that there have been odd things that have happened in the cemetery, etc. But I don't know for sure, but it's certainly a very odd kind of a central Illinois site.
Wow. Well, if people want to learn more about what's going on ghost-wise in Illinois and about what you do, where can they go to?
Well, you can go to the website. That's probably your best bet, which you go to www.historyandhauntings.com. And we've got a huge section right there at the top of our homepage. It links you to a section of Weird Illinois, and we've got tons of stuff, lots and lots of stories in different locations and sites. It only scratches the surface. We've got hundreds of sites in some of the books, and you can check that out on your own. But there's lots and lots of free information on the website that'll keep you busy all through the Halloween season.
Well, Troy, thanks for checking in with us again.
Oh, sure, absolutely.
That was Troy Taylor, one of the founders of the American Ghost Society and author of Haunted Illinois. Well, that does it for another edition of Sidetrack. Jay Pierce is our senior editor, and I'm your executive producer and host, Jason Croft. This episode, as well as all the past episodes of Sidetrack, are available in real audio on our website, and a lot of our past shows are also available as MP3 downloads. Just go to WILL.UIUC.edu, click Listen, and then select Sidetrack. Sidetrack is a production of AM 580, WILL Urbana.